You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. Now, over 50% of the Earth's population lives in cities, and in 40 years, that number is going to be 75%. So for all our griping about urban life, we seem to prefer cities over the alternatives. Or maybe, well, maybe we just don't have a choice. Writer and historian Leo Hollis is here, and he looks at the facts of urban life in his new book, Cities Are Good for You, The Genius of the Metropolis. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm so pleased that it brings Leo Hollis to the show today. Hello, Leo.
Good afternoon.
So you live in a city. You live in London.
That's right.
So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about what you like about London. And you really love cities. It's very clear from this book that you think cities are a great concept.
Absolutely. I think cities are, in some ways, the sort of best experiment, the best laboratory we've created in the last 7,000 years, that we've been coming together, living together, doing lots of different things. But the city has really been where so much creativity, the best ideas have come out of cities. And it's the best way that we've come to organize ourselves. So that's why I feel that we need to celebrate cities, when so often we spend so much time criticizing them, looking at the bad things within them, but actually looking at their qualities and what really makes cities good.
So we're going to try to emphasize positive things for the next 40 minutes. That's going to be a chore. We're going to have to really work hard on sort of reorienting my view. Although I will say, I live in New York City. I love New York City. So we can discuss it in both its positives and negatives. One of the positives, I understand, are our city bikes. Is it true that you've already tried our city bikes?
Yes, absolutely. I've been on them all week so far.
All week?
All week.
How's that going?
It's going very well. I mean, I've been on city bikes in sort of Paris and in London, so they are the same type of bike.
Oh, so are we late to this party?
I'm afraid to say you are, but it's still a very good addition, to the city. It has changed already the way that I sort of been traveling around New York, the way that I sort of see the streets. It's a great way to see the city. It reminds you how the different neighborhoods are connected. Mm-hmm. Undoubtedly, there are the nudging along of sharing a space with taxis and with trucks and everything like that, and that's testing.
Yes.
You have to be fairly aggressive to hold your line. I think the sort of system of bikeways is a really good start. It's got a long way to go. I think that the quality of the asphalt is interesting, but nonetheless, I think it really does add something to the city.
Now, since we're talking about cities, I think we each have our idea of what a city is, but actually when international agencies say that half of the world's population lives in cities, what are they counting as a city? What do they say a city is?
Well, I think as a sort of official definition, it's looking at a certain sort of measure of density of spaces where people are living very close together,
mm-hmm.
which is not necessarily my definition of what a city is, but it's those sort of agglomerations of huge masses of bodies, and usually what goes with those, which is a marketplace, which is sort of various types of trade,
services.
Mm-hmm. That is what in some ways the UN benchmark that the 50% is on, and where, in the next 40 years we're going to get to 75%. So that's looking at something like 180,000 people a day, sort of two every second, are arriving at the edge of a city and hoping to make it home.
Hoping to make it home. Well, now, a Kaiser Family Foundation, I just saw this, they call population of 2,000 or more urban. That doesn't sound, I don't know about you, that doesn't sound very urban to me. Do you think that still counts as a city if it's dense enough?
I think it's less to do with numbers and it's less to do with density. I think what really defines a city and what my book looks at in terms of the qualities of the city is the way that people interact. Cities are undoubtedly made of people rather than buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the way that we connect and interact within a city is what really makes us urban and what makes an urban society. So cities aren't just places. It's about the interweaving of human lives together. And once we start looking at cities as these kind of complex places, I think we start to sort of see the qualities that you miss if you just look at the physical or the sort of mass of bodies on its own.
Well, all of you city dwellers out here who are complaining about living in New York City, I have the most positive booster for cities, I think, on the planet. He's Leo Hollis, and he has written this great new book, Cities Are Good for You, The Genius of the Metropolis. Where this concept of the metropolis, where did that really start? I think of, you know, Fritz Lang's movie Metropolis, which is kind of the scary dystopian view of the future. Who came up with that whole idea of the metropolis?
The metropolis, oddly enough, was the first use of the word was in the 1650s.
And how big was a metropolis in
well,
the 1650s?
It was first used in London, right, during the sort of English Civil War, where London was sort of seen as in some ways the sort of the nursery of the Great Civil War, and the metropolis was the first moment, coming up to 500,000 people, where you started to sort of not know people walking through your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the start of that sort of breaking up of those traditional ties that one sort of sees in a town or in a village, that the metropolis was a new set of relationships, which was about having strong ties, but also linking yourself to this wider network of the city. And that's really what the metropolis is.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you bring up the English Civil War, because, of course, now we have lots of civil wars going on in the news. We've seen them all the time in the Middle East. And a lot of the unrest seems to be focused on the big city centers, where, you know, we see Tahrir Square and places like that. Has that traditionally been a function of cities to be kind of the engine of change, or the focus of change for an entire society?
I mean, on two hands, I think cities are undoubtedly incredibly creative places and places of innovation. It's where, you know, good ideas emerge. On the other hand, undoubtedly, I think that cities are places where protest and public space comes together.
Mm-hmm.
That you need these public squares and for this mass of bodies to congregate and to make their voice heard. Cities are both in some ways the problem and the solution.
Right. Well, and I would say, although the cities might be where the spark for a revolution starts, it's also kind of a dangerous place to be when there's a revolution. I mean, if you're somewhere out in the countryside, maybe you're less likely to get caught up in a riot. So isn't that sort of an argument for those, I will call myself cowardly, those cowardly souls among us to maybe be a little bit nervous about the city in times of great unrest?
Yes, but it also, if you want to be part of the change, or you want change to occur to you,
mm-hmm.
You know.
I'm the latter. I'm never part of the change. Things just happen to me.
But yes, no, but if you want to be, you know, if you see an injustice, you see an inequality, you know, the city is the place to come and, you know, make your voice heard. Because cities, not only do they amplify, you know, injustice and inequality, they are the one place where we can actually sort out these problems.
Right. Now, what about New York City is clearly a metropolis by most definitions of a metropolis. And yet Manhattan, of course, has this kind of primacy, which the people who live in the outer boroughs find very annoying. And people will say, I'm going into the city, right? And they mean Manhattan. And if you talk to a Brooklynite, they'll say, no, Brooklyn's a city. If we just separated out, our population would make us one of the biggest cities in the country. So you have a hard time convincing them that Manhattan is the be-all and end-all. Do you think that creates a kind of an interesting tension in the city, the individual boroughs having a sense of their own cityhood?
Absolutely. I don't sort of see a problem with that. I'm not necessarily creating an argument for, you know, sort of bland, homogenous places. I'm
right.
Looking for places which have individual neighborhoods that actually sort of grow from the bottom up, rather than being, you know, sort of controlled and given identities. So I believe that, you know, undoubtedly each of the five boroughs has to and should be allowed to come up with their own identity, develop their own voices, and that can be in terms of creativity or industry or you know, sort of political profile. So I feel that one should just allow these things to happen. One shouldn't have a kind of a hierarchy.
Right. But of course we do, because we're New Yorkers and we like to rank everything. You know, there's been a tremendous movement in this country, at least, back into the city. There was this whole period where we're getting suburban and then exurban and these big box stores and everything. And now all of a sudden everybody wants to have a place in the city, not just in New York, but all over the country. The city centers are coming back alive. But what that's doing is displacing a lot of people who used to be able to afford to live in the city, and now they can't because everything's gotten so gentrified. It raises the question, when you say cities are good for us, for whom? I mean, aren't they good for us if we can afford all the things that cities have to offer? But isn't there kind of a growing inequality in some American cities where the city centers have become prohibitively expensive to live in?
I think you're absolutely right that there is this sort of great inversion in which the sort of, as it were, the white suburbanites are coming back into the center of the city.
Oh, you had to bring race into it. You said I wasn't saying anything like that. And now all of a sudden you've created this firestorm of controversy. Go ahead.
Okay. So the suburbanites have come into the center, and there is a very much a change of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I think a sort of city is undoubtedly a place where inequality is given geography, that it is given different spaces, and you can sort of see that very clearly within the streets and within the housing of a city, the difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
What I propose in my book, and sort of coming up with a number of strategies, is how to sort of develop mixed neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Well, I think that it is incredibly difficult. Undoubtedly, it's one that starts off with both a political will as well as the will of the people who want to be within that neighbourhood. It's very rare to sort of find a good example where it is working 100%. But I think nonetheless, it's worth having the hope of being able to create a mixed neighbourhood which has services that is providing for everybody, mm-hmm. not just for those who've just come in and are pushing up the rent rates.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is sort of provisions of things like green spaces should be available in all neighborhoods. I think transit is incredibly important in a way of democratizing a city and making a more equal city. So a bus service that allows people to move from sort of poor neighbors into the sort of center of the city is absolutely essential. And I think there are really very interesting projects that are occurring in New York that are doing that. That really do understand that in some ways the sort of pavement is the public space of the city, that transit and public transit are the ways to get the city more democratic and working.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about that, because transportation is becoming a big, big, big issue here and in other cities as well. I'm speaking with Leo Hollis about why city living is actually good for you. His book, Cities Are Good for You, The Genius of the Metropolis, is published by Bloomsbury, and we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. And I know that many of you probably have some complaints about city life, complaints about this city that we live in, but not my guest, Leo Hollis. He loves the city. He loves the concept of the city. And he's written a whole book about it. Cities Are Good for You, The Genius of the Metropolis. Now, right before the break, we were talking about this issue of transportation. One thing you have to know is that on WNYC, every third program we air is about transportation. We have Transportation Nation. We have a transportation reporter. It's kind of a big deal around here. And one of the problems is that with this gentrification of pretty much every place, it's growing and growing all the time, people are now having to rent further and further out in the boroughs, and their commutes have gotten insane. I mean, they're an hour and a half both ways. What do you see is the solution to this? Because it's not just happening in New York, it's happening everywhere. Who fixes this? Do you need the federal government to take a look at cities? Do you need city by city to take care of themselves? How do you fix that problem? It's a big problem.
It's a big problem, and in many ways it's a global problem that quite a lot of the cities that we live in and quite a lot of the spaces that we spend our time were built in an age when the city was built around the car. Mm-hmm. And so we can't in some way sort of get over that sort of design fault. Nonetheless, I do believe that there are some really, really interesting things from around the world that we can actually learn. And actually, the places to look for, to look to when we're discussing sort of transport issues is not the sort of the normal places that we would imagine. It's not Europe and it's not America. It's actually Latin America. So mm-hmm. I think there are examples in Brazil, and there are examples also in Colombia, in particular in Bogota, where there are really, really interesting and really creative solutions that are coming about for transportation, using bus systems, using bike lanes as a real way of creating a more equal city, and you know, really stretching out all the way to the outer suburbs. I mean, I am absolutely passionate about the idea that, you know, transportation is one of the key I think one of the key parts of the right to the city. That we have to, everybody should have a right to the city, and this does mean public transit for everybody, not just from the most exclusive and sort of interesting neighbourhoods, but from the poorest neighbourhoods right to the centre of the city.
Now you're a big fan of the High Line. Have you spent a lot of time on the High Line? Or
I've been back on this trip. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about the High Line that you think? Is unique. Is what makes it great?
I love the idea of using something that is, as it were, from the previous city, so the industrial city, and reusing it and mm-hmm. creating
reclaiming
a space
it, yeah.
and reclaiming it and creating a space where people can be together. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that is really being squeezed within you know every major city is open public space.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can discuss whether the High Line is how open it is, but undoubtedly, compared to, you know, most cities, it is an incredibly valuable asset, in that it creates a place where people can come together, where they can sort of, as it were, sort of be together and interact and learn something about each other. And we need to sort of really protect these public spaces. So something like the High Line is a really good signal to other cities about what is possible.
One thing that I love about New York City as the father of a three-year-old is the playgrounds. I mean, there are these wonderful playgrounds and they're so accessible and they're all over. And that's actually something you don't get in the country. Like in the country, you have to drive quite a distance. If you're, you know, if you're out in the country, you're visiting, you're on vacation or whatever, it actually is a big it's a big move to try to find a playground for your kids to play, and they're likely not going to be meeting other kids from their neighborhood because they're meeting other kids who've driven miles and miles to get there. That's something that you talk about in the book. You talk about these tremendous services that the cities provide, these institutions. What are the institutions you think make a city great, that make cities good for us?
Well, I mean, starting off with that notion of children in the city, which I think is absolutely essential. I really do believe that cities are very good places to raise children. However, I do believe that we could do better. I mean, there's if we gave as much of the city to children as we did to cars, just imagine what kind of city we would be living in. You know, if I think a child in the city should have, you know, daily contact with green spaces, and play parks are a fantastic way for them to sort of socialize and to sort of learn the rules of, you know, in some ways sort of being in the city, of sharing, of play. Thinking about the institutions of the city in general, what I feel that we don't spend enough time thinking about, and is really in some ways the unit of measure for any sort of really interesting city, in my opinion, is the street. You know, we take streets for granted, and we don't really think about the relationship between, as it were, the door front, the pavement, and the roadway, and you know, who owns what and what's allowed to happen. You know, it is the street that was really at the heart of Jane Jacobs' ideas when she was talking about the ballet of Hudson Street, and that interaction, that sort of public space, is really what makes a city supercharged and energized and exciting. You know, I think we could just start thinking about making a resilient city from the street up.
Mm-hmm.
That there are a number of plans and, you know, huge schemes about resilience, which are coming from sort of City Hall, and they're sort of going to be imposed upon the city. But actually, if we start really caring and putting all the effort into the places within in front of our houses, then I think that really is the way of building the city from the ground up.
Now, here's a sort of a contradiction of life in New York City. If New York City is this destination that tourists want to come to and everybody wants to hang out, and there are all these great museums and Broadway shows and all the things that tourists do. And yet, if you live here, so many people think, well, if I only got a little extra money somehow, or I won the lottery, the first thing I would do is buy a place out of town. I would get a place in the country. I would get a place on the beach. If cities have so much to offer, why are New Yorkers so fixated on finding a way to get out of the city? Especially at this time of year, I guess it makes sense, especially with 94-degree weather. It makes sense to want to go to the beach. But it is this pretty common dream among New Yorkers to have that place out of town. And in London, too, isn't that a sign of success? You know, people have a place, you know, in the Cotswolds or something like that.
Yes, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I mean, it does have an impact on those rural communities. That, you know, that there are now villages ringing London that are empty 5 days of the week, which does sort of create some sort of tension within those villages. I don't see necessarily a problem with leaving the city for a weekend or going on holiday. I think that's allowed, and I think undoubtedly there is always a desire to just take a breath, mm-hmm. just to relax, and one can do that in the countryside. You can also do it in the city, but it's the variety, and you know, the key factor in that is in some ways. I feel that the best way that we can in some ways look after the countryside is by getting the cities right. And I think that the countryside is incredibly important, and I think it's a place where, you know, children should go. But having said that, last time I was here I went to Fresh Kills, which is the new park which is down in Staten Island, which I think is going to turn out to be the most extraordinary resource for the city as a place to go to, which is you know, almost like countryside.
Wow.
So I think it's really a very exciting place that is developing over the next few years.
Okay, well, shout out to Staten Island from Leo Hollis. Came all the way from England to compliment Staten Island. That's quite a thing. Leo has written this fascinating book, Cities Are Good for You, The Genius of the Metropolis, and we're talking about all the good things about cities. Now, there's some scary things about cities, especially there's some, you know, you called cities the great laboratory, as you pronounced it. We say laboratory in America. But as a place where all these great new ideas are developed. Of course, the Chinese, you'd almost say, are being like, you know, the mad scientists of city life now, because they're creating gigantic cities from nothing. Can you tell us a little bit about what they're doing and why they're doing it and where this is all going to lead?
Well, it's fascinating. If one imagines that between now and 2050, 80% of all cities that are going to exist in 1850 haven't been built. No, sorry, not 1850, 2050 haven't been built yet. So there are these extraordinary experiments that are occurring. So there are, you know, sort of seven cities the size of London being built. All times that these mega cities which are being built even before the people arrive. In China, there is what they would call creative destruction in the existing cities, like sort of Shanghai and Beijing. This isn't just in China; it's also happening throughout Asia and Africa. And these are the areas in the next 40-50 years where there is going to be extraordinary population growth. While Tokyo and London and New York are going to grow by perhaps 1% a year, these other places are going to double in size in a decade. So they have, in some ways, a blank slate to experiment. And there are some extraordinary experiments that are going on. If you think of in Abu Dhabi, there is a city that's being built by the designer Norman Foster called Masdar, which is almost carbon neutral. There's another city in Songdo, which is in Korea, which is completely being built with a sort of intelligent city in mind. So software being placed throughout the city in order to make it an incredibly, in some ways, an internet of things. So it is computerized and monitored, and information is changing the way that we work and move through that city. I think what's happening in China is the rate. It's the speed that things are going on, which is so shocking. Because essentially the cities that they're building is often nothing new. You know, they're not doing anything different. In some ways, they're sort of taking ideas off the shelf from various different other continents and just building it at a rate that we've never seen before.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lope today on WNYC and WNYC.org. There are these cities, you know, in the Western world like New York and London that are expanding or growing kind of a stable way. But then there are places like Mumbai and Beijing, which are growing so exponentially. I have a child actually who's studying in Beijing right now, and he is wearing a mask every day because of the pollution. It's so terrible. Isn't this a sort of a dangerous aspect of our fascination with cities, is that cities become overcrowded, they become unmanageable in a way. There's that tipping point where they tip from utopia into dystopia of some kind.
I think there's always a risk of that, particularly when sort of looking at things like sort of pollution or you know, just getting around the city, and undoubtedly in places like Beijing where as it were, the sort of traditional image of bicycles have been replaced by cars, and cars as sort of the status symbol of the rising middle classes, and as a result it's become incredibly polluted. And you know, the whole idea of sort of, you know, finding parking spaces is in Beijing is almost an impossibility. If you imagine that, for example, 40% of all traffic in Park Slope, I read, is looking for a parking space. In Beijing, it's even worse. I mean, so what one needs to do as one, you know, develops these cities, and I think Beijing is, you know, can do it. Well, I think Mumbai has a number of different stresses and problems. Is design the city with this in mind, that we have the knowledge and we have the as it were, the will to create good cities. And to be able to, in some ways, not necessarily control the growth, but monitor it and respond to it. In Mumbai, I think the stresses are very, very different, because you have a city which is almost without that kind of sort of basic infrastructure that we take for sort of granted here. You know, almost 62% of people live in informal settlements or sort of slum type areas like Dharavi. I think really that the problems that have occurred and the reactions to Dharavi have been very top down. They have been very much either bulldozer it or tell the people what they're supposed to be doing. Well, actually, if you look at Dharavi and you walk through those streets, they are extraordinarily industrial places. They are, in some ways, arrival cities where, within a generation, somebody comes in and might then get into the sort of move through the slums and then into the sort of city. That there is a real potential of becoming citizens through the slum. I believe that the in some ways, you know, the people who should be, or we should be listening to, the people who should be governing and directing what goes on in those areas are, in fact, the people who live there. They shouldn't be politicians. They shouldn't be property developers. It should be the people who really know what's going on. And that, I think, is what is going to be happening. That every, you know, walking through a place like Dharavi, it is astonishing what you see. And, of course, the level of inequality is shocking, but you then sort of see this sort of level of industry. It's very, you know, in some ways it's very encouraging, it's very exciting, it's also very shocking.
Mm-hmm. In America, we have these so-called Rust Belt cities. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I don't know if you've ever had the honor of visiting Cleveland.
No.
Well, check it out for your next book. Of course, Detroit, which you write about, is more famously troubled economically. These cities where they were thriving on a core business that has been, diminished or, endangered over the last 50 years. What's the roadmap for them? Is there a chance that Cleveland could come back? Is there a chance that Detroit could come back? How would they do that? What would be your diagnosis, your prescription, rather?
I mean, the prescription is really listening to people who are there rather than, sort of me coming in and giving.
Oh, we're not going to solve this on public radio? I thought that was our job.
I mean, what I would say is that there are obviously there are signs in Detroit that there are things that are occurring that, last year there were more, high tech jobs in Detroit than there were in Silicon Valley, that it is still a place where there is a lot of industry. What I think has occurred with Detroit is geographical. It's the space in which the city has changed over the last 20, 30 years. So one needs to look at it in terms of sort of neighborhoods and communities. And I think it's absolutely right that on one hand we need to sort of look at education, but you also need to again go back to that idea of transport, about allowing people to be able to move through the spaces. I mean, I'm not expert enough to be able to sort of talk about de-densification and the idea of moving, which I think sort of Mayor Bing was talking about moving neighborhoods around and moving communities so that they are, so it creates a more sort of dense core. I think that's sort of works on paper, but clearly, I think Mayor Bing has been surprised by the reaction to that.
Well, I've been speaking with Leo Hollis about his book, Cities Are Good for You, The Genius of the Metropolis. He is the most optimistic man I've ever met. It's been a pleasure. It's published by Bloomsbury. Leo, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.